Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is John Pomfret, who is a correspondent for the Washington Post. As a foreign correspondent, he has covered Bosnia, the Balkans, China, the Congo, and was recently the bureau chief in Beijing. He is now the bureau chief in Los Angeles, and he's about to become editor of the Outlook section of the Washington Post. He has just written a book about his experiences in China, both as a student and as a reporter. It's called Chinese Lessons. John, welcome back to Berkeley.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be back.
How did you come to write this book?
Well, at the end of my tour, my third time living in China in 2003, I very much wanted to write a book about China. I'd lived there on and off for the last 20-some-odd years. But I didn't want to do what was sort of the normal foreign correspondent thing to do, which is to pull up all your really good stories and slap them together into a good book and put a theme on top of that and hope to have a good thing to sell. I wanted to write something a little bit different, and I'd had this unusual experience as a foreign student in China in the early 80s. And a friend of mine, there was a photograph that's on the front cover of the book that has followed me around wherever I've been. And a friend of mine and I were sort of looking at my wall one day and looking at that photograph, and he said, you know, that's really your book. Why don't you go back and find those guys and write about them? And so what I did was, over the course of 2003, 2004, I went back and found all the people that I'd lost touch with and got closer to the people who I'd kept in touch with and constructed a book about their lives as a way to write about how China's changed since the late 50s and early 60s until today.
And we need to go back and talk a little more about your background, because you were uniquely situated. You, in the 80s, you were an undergraduate in Stanford, and then you decided to go to China as an exchange student. In what year?
I made the decision to go in 79, and then the opportunity came to go in 80. So it was very early. I just finished my junior year at Stanford, and professors there encouraged me, even though they didn't have programs for undergraduates, just to use any trick in the book to get there. And so through a professor, American-Chinese professor at Stanford Linear Accelerator, who had an old classmate in Beijing who was running the Beijing Language Institute, we started to write, and he invited me to come to China. And the visas took a long time then as well, but nonetheless it worked out, and so I got a chance to go.
And this was really before you were had decided you were going to be a journalist. You were just a student of Asian affairs. And so had you already studied the Chinese language?
I studied 1 year of college Chinese. Actually, and then I'd taken a year off to just focus on complete academics and stop language for a while. Mm-hmm. And then I took a summer at Berkeley, and then I went to Beijing.
And so in that year, what was China like when you first arrived? I mean, this is before the wave of capitalism that was to come. Talk about it.
When we look at the photographs today of Beijing and Shanghai, these amazing skyscrapers, these skylines, this right out of cartoons like the Jetsons. I mean, it's very difficult to believe that Beijing, the tallest building was maybe 14 stories. In Nanjing, the city where I went to university, the tallest building was less than 10. This was a desperately poor country. And the colors on the streets, the clothes people wore were only blue and green. Occasionally you'd see children with colorful clothes, but that was about it. The markets were empty. The shelves were bare. It was really a very, very dismal place. Dust hung over the air everywhere.
And no real highways yet.
No highways. Bicycles everywhere. Very few private cars. Mm-hmm. A lot of these east wind trucks barreling up and down and through these rutted streets. Open sewers. Mm-hmm. It's a very, pungent place, but fascinating nonetheless, especially for a kid who grew up in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess the first question becomes, was this just your destiny or what? I mean, because for a junior, it must have taken a lot of gumption, and then also a real inquisitive exploring mind.
Yeah, the Chinese have a term for it. They call it yuan fen, which means it's sort of a term that things that are fated to be to happen. It's a Buddhist terminology. And I think that had a lot to do with it. I was just pushed in that direction. And a variety of things sort of worked together to put me on the road to going to China. Indeed, a year before, I'd applied to go to Taiwan to teach as a foreign student teaching English in Taiwan, and I was rejected to do that. And if I hadn't been rejected, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to the mainland, which was by far the most fascinating of the two experiences. In terms of gumption, not so much. I mean, I was 21. I was footloose. I wanted an adventure, and it was just and I was interested in China. And at that time, China was a buzz in the news. I mean, the Chinese had attacked Vietnam. Deng Xiaoping had come to America. We were normalizing relations, and so there was this buzz about China. It was the latest thing as far as we were all many of us were concerned, and so going there for me was really, I mean, the hippest thing I could imagine.
One of the images that sticks out as I read the book was the lowly freshman, although you were a junior, arriving at the dorm. What was that like experiencing this new way of life, which every undergraduate has when they go off to college, but they're going off maybe to Stanford or the Ivy League or a state university?
Well, this was a dorm like no other dorm I'd ever experienced. Mm-hmm. I mean, my first semester in China was doing language training, and so I was living with one other Westerner in a dorm that was relatively similar to the type of dorm you might have in America. I mean, pretty low standard, but the reason why I applied to go to Nanjing University was that I knew there you could live with Chinese, not simply with a Chinese person living in a foreigner's dormitory, but actually with foreigners living in a Chinese dormitory. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to have that experience, and they said yes. Nanjing University was the one place where you could do that. And so in early February of 1981, I find myself in this dorm room knocking open the door, and there's seven guys. Actually, there are eight guys that day that I walked in, four bunk beds, four tables, eight stools, and in all their clothes packed in these leather or cardboard briefcases shoved underneath their mattresses and their beds. The place was literally like a 1930s work camp type feel, packed in. I'd never lived with seven other guys before, but it was really an amazing experience.
And how hard was it to break the ice? I mean, were you the embodiment of the running dogs of capitalism in their eyes, or they hadn't bought into what had been the line before?
You know, I mean, a few people bought into that line, but, you know, the Chinese by that time were so tired of ideological campaigns, and they were so instinctively distrustful of their government, that when an American showed up in their midst and began to communicate with them relatively normally, my Chinese was lousy, but it got pretty good pretty quickly, they would, in many cases, open up to me, in fact, much more than they would to their other classmates, because I wasn't a particular threat. Mm-hmm. If I learned secrets about them, they knew that I was not going to go around their back and tell it to somebody. And they also, several of them, obviously looked at me as a potential someone who could benefit them, because having access to the outside world, I could get them college applications, et cetera, because many of them wanted to go overseas. I did a lot of college essay writing while I was in China for those couple of years.
And so your coursework and your interaction in the classroom, tell us a little bit.
The coursework was Chinese history. Mm-hmm. I was a Chinese history major, and the courses were really stultifyingly boring. Chinese history and the teaching of Chinese history has always been tightly controlled in China, because Mao himself, a historian of some repute, understood that if you controlled history, one of the things you very much controlled was the whole way of how history was looked at and how regimes got their legitimacy or lost their legitimacy. And so our history was basically pablum served up to us by history professors, many of whom who had been through hell during the Cultural Revolution. And these people were not the type of people who would openly criticize anymore, because they had suffered so much that they were pretty much cowed. Mm-hmm. So the classes were boring, a lot of repetition, a lot of memorization.
Did you ever go home with any of your fellow students? Were you invited to come meet the family during the holidays?
That happened on several occasions. Each time it was preceded by a long period of them requesting first the Nanjing University Party Committee to allow them permission to ask me to their house, and then to the local party committee who controlled their neighborhood to allow them permission to let the foreigner come to the house. And that application process could take as long as a month.
Mm-hmm. Now, I would imagine that on these visits, the families were there's something about Chinese hospitality that's truly wonderful, and it must have been the case even, you know, in times where the poverty was even greater than it is now and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I had a teaching job in Beijing just to make a little sideline money, and some of my students would invite me over to their houses, and I later learned literally they were spending the equivalent of a month's salary just to feed me for one evening. Mm-hmm. And I only learned that later. But that's the type of hospitality that was regularly doled out to foreigners at that time.
Now, I was curious, as you go back into the past history of your fellow students and tell their stories, and some of the stories are quite harsh, and I must say that your book captures in a way the atrocities, the horrible things that were done to people during the Cultural Revolution that you can read about in a kind of general way, but when you hear it through the words of one person's story, it's quite something. Did you know of these stories before you came to write the book? I mean, were you hearing these stories back when you were a student?
Back when I was a student, I had heard similar stories to what these people had gone through. In case of several characters of the book, I discovered their stories later on, because I interviewed so many of my classmates at such length that newer stories came out or newer characters came out that I didn't think would be prominent characters. These people surfaced as more prominent characters in the reporting of the book. But yeah, I was aware of the horror. And at that time, actually, I mean, we were reading in Samizdat version form a lot of what they called the scar literature, the Shanghan Wenxue, which was being published then, which delved into these type of atrocities with not as much of a pointed political edge as my book does, because that would have been against the rules. But nonetheless, there was a lot of discussion about the horrors of the Cultural Revolution in the early years of the 1980s. A lot more than there is now, actually, which is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And what I wonder, before we talk about what happened to these people as they rode the wave of China's development and the opening up of capitalist opportunities, are there, as you gather these stories, what themes stand out, a particular case of what these fellow students had gone through before, you know, that time when you actually met them?
It's that you looked at them when you walked into the dorm room, and you know, in addition to being crowded, but they had a studiousness that was equivalent to some of the harder working universities in America. Mm-hmm. And so on the surface, they were very nerdy. But when you scratch that nerdiness, it revealed this pedestrian quality of the horror that they dealt with mm-hmm. on a daily basis. And that disconstruct, or that contradiction between this bookishness and this real violence that they had to deal with growing up, to me, was something that was really unusual and really profoundly, in some ways, unnerving. Because they could, I mean, these are people whose, I mean, in one case, one of my classmates, his parents were murdered during the Cultural Revolution. And that guy never talked about it to any of his classmates. Mm-hmm. I mean, only a little. In fact, in many cases, he ended up sharing more with me than he did with any of his classmates, because I kept on asking about it with him. Mm-hmm. But this guy was completely and totally self-contained. And to look at him, you'd think, you'd have no idea, obviously, anything had happened to him, and to watch how he acted. But at the same time, under that bookish exterior, there was real tragedy and real pain.
So was it compartmentalization that you witnessed, as opposed to, very angry people who would suddenly have a burst of anger over some criminal?
Well, it's funny. I mean, people make this distinction between the Russians and the Chinese. They say the Russians who lived under Stalin were angry, mm-hmm. Whereas the Chinese who lived under Mao basically became numb. Mm-hmm. I don't really know if that's particularly true, but I mean, I can see how that distinction's been made. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting one to think out a bit, but it's a distinction that's been made, and I find it's a very fascinating one. And the Chinese say, look, when Deng Xiaoping came, he gave us the opportunity to forget. And what we wanted more than anything else to do was to forget and to build something new with our lives. And so many of the people actively set about forgetting the past. And because society didn't really allow a deep sense of closure on this issue, mm-hmm. no truth commissions, etc., families then took the easy way out, and they didn't talk about what happened within the family. Mm-hmm. Neighborhoods, obviously, institutions didn't look at what happened within the institutions. And so as with the society and the government and the party state setting the tone of, you can criticize this a little bit, but not too much. I think a lot of people took their cues from that and basically said, let's just move forward and ultimately make as much money as we can.
When you look at this and think about it, is there some sense that you have of the interplay between the party and what it had done and the culture and how it allowed it to happen and how it then recovered from what had happened and help navigate the change in the party's position in its own past?
You can see that in some ways by looking at some of the factors that contributed to the economic reforms. I mean, in the West, it's very easy to say, well, Deng Xiaoping came in and he instituted these reforms, and then the people followed him, and then China became a much wealthier society. But the reality was that Deng Xiaoping came into power, and in large parts of the countryside, the party was about to lose control, mm-hmm. where peasants were refusing to rejoin the communes because they knew the communes would fail them should there be a famine, and where local party secretaries, in order to win the support of the peasantry, had to begin to experiment with new forms of ownership, allowing peasants to have private plots, etc. And so a lot of the economic reforms were not so much brought down from above as they were experiments that started from below that the folks on the top knew they had to accept because they had no other way to reignite China's economic growth. Mm-hmm. And that is also part of the process of how the society began to, in some ways, not necessarily heal itself, but to balm its wounds by allowing artists and writers to begin to write about these scar literature issues so they could explore some of the wounds of the Cultural Revolution, but only to a certain extent. Because once you got into an argument that would criticize the nature of the communist system, that was going to be censored completely. Mm. But as long as you could sort of balm your wounds a bit and then move forward, that would be allowed. And that type of trade-off of we'll let you speak a little bit but not too much, mm-hmm. was something that the people generally accepted. Because once people started speaking too much, as in the case of the Democracy Wall movement, they were thrown into jail.
Mm-hmm. So. And as I mentioned earlier, and you just touched on some of the individual case stories that you tell of people having to denounce their own parents or grandparents, watching their death, watching their beatings, and so on. I mean, really traumatic in a kind of raw, visceral sense that was really quite something. So, in a way, this moment in time when you're meeting these people is a tipping point, basically, for confronting their past, the country's past, and then facing the new openings that are coming.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really know if you can say they were confronting the past so much. I mean, everything that the government did and everything they were told to do in class was to ignore the past.
I see.
And to move forward. And the expression that was popular then was Wang Qian Kan, which means look to the future, but it also means look show me the money. Basically, mm-hmm. it's one of these interesting polyphenoms in Chinese, which you know, the same expression sounds means different things, and that's what the society was encouraging them to do. Personally, there were probably people who tried to confront their past then, but the general push of the party state was, don't look back, because if you do look back, then you'll have to question why we're still in control. Mm-hmm. And the party state didn't want anyone to do that. So they were encouraged to look forward and to get their education on a roll and to get a good job and to make money.
What was your sense at the time of the way things were opening up and the response that we were seeing? And I mean, it must have been an exciting time. I mean, if I think back in the early 60s were a time, very different situations and not comparable in some sense. But then on the other hand, there must have been an excitement in the air.
The place had been under such a repressive regime for so long that, yes, when the Gang of Four fell and into the mid-80s, there was definitely that sense of possibility. And then there were these occasional spasmodic leftist, conservative, it's very interesting because in China leftist and conservative mean the same thing, backlashes, mm-hmm. which would say no long hair among boys on college campuses, no dances, no more poetry contests, etc. And that would happen for maybe 3 or 4 months, and then there'd be a liberal push that said, okay, you can grow your hair longer, you can go to dances, you can have a foreign boyfriend, and then there'd be another conservative push. And so there was a very spasmodic, as the factions in Beijing battled, the manifestation of their fights would pop up at university campuses with these big red wall posters we'd see every so often that were completely contradictory 1 month to the next.
Mm-hmm. So before we talk about the latter part, the themes that emerge in, you know, once capitalism hits and the things that you learned about what happened to these people after, let's talk about Tiananmen, because you were you had become a journalist and then I guess left China, then you came back, and then that whole movement began, and you were working for the AP, and you were on the scene and so on, and give us a sense of that excitement, which you talk about in the book, and the time of possibilities.
Well, I mean, Tiananmen, you know, I was in China from 1980 to 82, and then I left, and then I became a journalist and got training back in the States, and then I was sent by the AP to China in late 88. And actually, the first demonstration I was sent to was in Nanjing in December of 1988. And it was this very strange demonstration. I'll talk about this for a second before we get to Tiananmen. That demonstration began when a African student wanted to take his girlfriend to a dance, his Chinese girlfriend. And Nanjing, like lots of other cities, had these waves of crackdowns on foreigner-Chinese relationships. And it was in the middle of one such crackdown, so it was bad timing. So when the African student tried to take his girlfriend to the dance, the guy at the gate said, she has to register. Mm-hmm. And the African student knew that if that woman had registered, she would be contacted by the police, there would be problems for her. So he said, no, she's not going to register. The guy at the gate said, she must register, so a fight ensues. By the end of the evening, 11 African students are wounded. I think 3 Chinese students were hurt. And the whole city is bananas with these thousands of Chinese youths marching down the street saying, down with the black devils. By the next day, tens of thousands of people are on the street marching against African students, the black devils, as they're called in Chinese, in China, saying, we want these people out of our country, blah, blah, blah. So I go down there, I think, on like the end of the second day. And by the third day, the demonstrations has lost all of these racist overtones, and it's already morphed into a demonstration for democracy and human rights. Go figure. But that disconnect in a foreign mind is one of the things that happened so often in China. Mm-hmm. You have this anger about a nativistic, could be a racially motivated anger, that morphed rapidly into an anti-regime type protest march. So when the demonstrations began about Hu Yaobang in April of 1989, no one among the foreign community realized that this thing was going to be big. It was demonstrating because this poor old communist had died without much fanfare. and they began to demonstrate for a better funeral for this character. And soon into April, we had, after several weeks of demos, you had 100,000 people on the streets in Beijing. And then in May, you had 500,000 people, possibly more than a million, maybe 2 million people on the streets in Beijing. One of the reasons, obviously, was because within the Communist Party, there was a lot of factional fighting. But the complicated thing in China is that demonstrations against or for one thing can quickly morph into an anti-regime demonstrations that will literally shake the very foundations of the Communist Party. Being in Beijing at that time was, for a 30-year-old reporter, the most amazing experience at that time of my life up to that point. You're watching history happen before you. In some cases, you could literally look down on history, because in Beijing there are lots of these elevated sidewalks over boulevards. And the boulevards weren't filled with cars. They were filled with people, with these banners stretching up and down the street, literally for miles as far as the eye can see, with these wonderful slogans of, like, you know, down with corruption, we want human rights and freedom. It's just really an extraordinary... And Beijing people have a reputation, of course, as being very city-fied, obnoxious, sort of like New Yorkers in a way. And then suddenly, for several weeks in April, May, and June of 1980, people became nice to each other again. You bumped into people on the street, and they would say, "Excuse me." Mm-hmm. I mean, which is extraordinary, because Beijing never did that. So, from all sorts of levels, the change in the way society felt then was extraordinary.
And it moved away from corruption and issues about who could get into school and so on to broader political issues. It started with students and then was mobilizing all sectors of the society.
Right. It metastasized, as the party would say.
Yeah.
I mean, the basic demand, the first demand, was to set up a student union independent of Communist Party control. And people can say, how obscure is that? But actually, it's an important point, because if you establish the precedent of an organization outside the control of the party, then you really have the potential for creating civil society, and that's the last thing the party wanted. And then, of course, it moved into all reaches of society, into all reaches of the party.
Was that because you were there on the street, you know, working many, many hours and filing reports, a young person, a lot of energy, but who spoke Chinese? I mean, fate was with you then to be there, and so on. Were you stung by the how ugly things got? I mean, or had you experienced things before as a student that made it that you weren't surprised by what you saw?
You know, I had a bad sense. I had a sense that things would end badly, because too many people whom I respected kept on saying this is going to end badly. And so that influenced my thinking. But once it began, I happened to be at Mushidi when the soldiers began firing to come into the city from the west on the night of June 3rd. Once that firing began and literally bullets were flying over my head, I had no idea what I was into. It was an experience that I'd never had. I'd never seen combat. I'd never heard gunfire in that type of an environment at all. I'd never seen a riot like this, and I'd never seen a bloody response. I mean, an armed response. I mean, I'd covered cop incidents in New York City, but this was live. It was a totally different nature than that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was pretty.
And you ultimately were thrown out of the country by the Chinese government.
There were two resident correspondents kicked out. I was one of the two resident correspondents expelled. My crimes were stealing state secrets and violating martial law provisions.
But what you were really guilty of is had access to information that would be out shortly thereafter anyway.
Well, I think that was the essential problem, right?
Yeah. So after you left China, you really went to a number of hotspots all over the world. I don't want to talk about those, but what I'm interested in is how your later experience informs your attitude about the way you see Tiananmen now as opposed to the way you saw it then. Your thoughts?
I think my views on Tiananmen fundamentally haven't changed. There were a lot of innocent people who were killed that evening for no need. The Chinese shibboleth that if we'd listened to these people, if we hadn't killed these people, China would be in chaos. I don't buy it. On the other hand, having seen the destruction of Bosnia and the collapse of Yugoslavia, having been for many weeks in Mobutu Zaire and seen his fall, and literally seen the Gulf War, seen Afghanistan, seen Sri Lanka and its horrible and intractable civil war, you have to give the Chinese Communist Party some credit that their unity has at least stopped their country from falling apart into a destructive, unproductive, and bloody civil war. And that's the last thing you'd want to wish on anybody, mm-hmm. no matter their political affiliation. So, like I said, fundamentally, my views haven't changed. It was a crackdown on innocent students and civilians done by a bunch of old men desperate to hold on to power. But what happened afterward, I think, is a testimony to some of the very Chinese creativity and entrepreneurial spirit that the country really is so prominent and powerful today.
Mm-hmm. So let's now talk about the students and what became of them, or the ones you're profiling in some kind of general sense, after the change that occurred in the 90s. Was it hard to find the students, to find out what happened to them in their later life, and how did you go about doing that?
It's funny, 25 years ago or so, alumni associations in China were illegal, but mm-hmm. China's changed a lot. It really has, and personal freedom is much greater than it used to be. And even though now all organizations still are under party control, the party has allowed a lot more organizations to appear under its control. Mm-hmm. And so alumni associations are alive and well. And so I got the alumni book from my class, and I wrote them all a form letter, effectively, saying, this is who I am. You obviously remember me. I was this lone round guy in room number one.
Yeah.
And, I'd like to come and sit with you, and visit you wherever you are. And out of 63 letters I sent out, I got about 57, 58 responses, effectively saying, come on down.
Mm.
And so I literally traveled the globe, because there were interviews in Salt Lake City and Rome, in Livingston, New Jersey, and, of course, all over China, with people about their lives, and they were incredibly welcoming. Now, several of them who had higher level party positions would meet with me, but always avoided the one-on-one, didn't really want to go into things too much, but others were very, very open, shockingly so. And I really respect their courage in speaking so openly about me, about their lives with me.
And so what common themes emerged? I mean, you're suggesting that some had been dispersed all over the world. I mean, they had taken the opening to the West seriously and moved to different places.
Yeah, I mean,
is that what percentage would you say of the people, or a small percentage?
Of my classmates?
Yeah.
Of the 63 classmates, 5 live abroad.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a relatively small percentage for that university year. In the computer sciences departments, you're going to have upwards of 50% living abroad still, because their opportunities were enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into places like MIT, Caltech, et cetera. They've been Tsinghua University graduates to go all over the world these days. But these folks were graduates in history, which was generally a pretty low major then. It is in American schools these days, from what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in terms of, their standard of living, this is China's middle class. These people.
You mean now talking about the whole group?
The whole group.
Yeah, yeah.
These people, when they graduated university, were making $10 a month generally, was using those days' exchange figures, about $10 a month, and now they're making $1,000 a month, and that enormous increase in material wealth has really been evidenced by their lives. 63 of them, of the 63 of them, 5 years ago about 10 had cars. I think now about 25 had cars, and you have people who are now in their 50s learning how to drive, which is a scary thing if you've ever been on China's streets, but it's this desire for the new that's very strong. All of them own their own apartments. Some of them have these massive plasma TVs, which are bigger than my car. many of their kids are going abroad, which is interesting because they're achieving a dream that these people didn't quite achieve, because their generation very much wanted to go abroad. Not so many of them did, but their children are now going abroad. Mm-hmm. But their children don't necessarily want to go abroad to live. Mm-hmm. They might want to go along to, as a tourist. I mean, now Chinese tourism to Europe is quite popular, mm-hmm. But they come home. Mm-hmm. So it's a real sense of this middle class existence with their SMS text on their phones, their high speed internet connections, their fancy centrally air conditioned apartments. It's an interesting bunch.
Did some not change very much at all, or were those the party types that you've already just talked about?
Well, the party types did change. I mean, one of my main characters in the book, we called him Big Bluffer. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was always a big bluffer. He was a great card player, and so he was a bit of a gambler. But he changed with the times, and he became quite, as a party official in Nanjing, quite creative in helping his local district grow its economy, embracing capitalist tactics at every turn. And literally, in one case, he came to Vegas, and he got religion, and he brought a whole neon light strip back to his little district in Nanjing. And then he topped it with a Chinese dragon to give it a sort of oriental flair. But he was quite flexible and creative, at the same time quite ruthless in achieving his goals. And so we had this mix of this totalitarian thing at the same time with this free market tinge to it, which I think very much sums up how the Communist Party is dealing with China today.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about middle class, that can mean two things. The dark side of the middle class is a kind of focus on the me generation, on self-aggrandizement, not worrying about the broader community on the one hand, but the middle class also is always the backbone of democracy, the people who are doing the reading, who want to become engaged politically and so on. What do you see in China in terms of these two conflicting currents sometimes?
I think you have the same currents in China.
Yeah.
What happened after 89 was that for several years there was this kind of collapse into very conservative policies where all economic reforms were halted, the economy slowed, foreign investment began to dry up, opportunities for foreigners decreased, and even places like Shenzhen, Beijing started to criticize Shenzhen for doing too many joint ventures, saying you're selling China's gold, the eggs to the foreigners. And it was a very tricky period. Then in 1992, Deng Xiaoping goes to Shenzhen and basically says to Beijing, forget all your leftist claptrap. We need to open our economy. And to the Chinese people, what he says is, okay, we killed a bunch of you in 1989, fine. You know that politics is not a possible door for you to run through, but you can get rich. And from 1992 to this day, he launched his country on this very single-minded pursuit of riches. And that change in allowing Chinese to become agents of their own fate has been an enormous change in the society, that people now can say, I want to be a when I grow up. Mm-hmm. Whereas previously, your job was assigned, your university was almost always picked for you, your major was definitely picked for you, the place you lived, your work unit, everything was all decided for you. Even when you could have a baby was decided for you. When you could get married was decided. Those things have all gone away. You now can have those decisions. You're limited to only one child, but you can have it whenever you want. You can marry. If previously, when you wanted to get a divorce, you had to get permission. Now you don't have to. These type of things. So the sense of man or woman as an agent of their own fate is now coming into China. Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, these people are the middle class, because the middle class were really, in Western history, the first agents of their own fate as well, really, other than the aristocracy. And so that change in China's sort of sensibilities about what the Chinese can do was really something that was started by Deng Xiaoping.
Now, what about the urge for democracy, for true democracy? Is that bubbling from the bottom, or it's being controlled because of the satisfaction with what we've just discussed?
Deng has been very, and the party state after Deng died, have been very good at buying off China's elite. Mm-hmm. China's elite has a good deal. If you exclude the whole political issue, they have access to all the information they want, pretty much. And in fact, in many Chinese small property developments, like housing developments, if the educational level of the people living in those housing developments is higher, they can have access to satellite TV. Mm-hmm. Whereas the people in the low-end housing developments don't have access to satellite TVs, which means you can't see foreign broadcasts. I mean, it's this kind of distinction that the party's making. And so the elite is benefiting from this. And they, you know, they get passports, they can mm-hmm. go overseas, etc. And then they also can have three nannies for $18 a month. Mm-hmm. And so because the differentials between rich and poor in China are so wide now that it's very easy to live like a king in China as long as you make a little money. And so from that perspective, the middle class is very much in some ways supportive of the regime. But there are problems, though, mm-hmm. because when the regime comes up against the middle class, for example, in terms of property deals, now that the middle class can afford to buy their own homes, Harry, you mm-hmm. buy your apartment, which is supposed to be 900 square feet, you move in, it's actually only 750, you go to sue the property developer, and then you discover that he's actually in cahoots with the local neighborhood party guy. Mm-hmm. That type of tension is increasing. Mm-hmm. And so on one hand, while the party is bending over backwards to make sure you have a good life, on the other hand, the party's also screwing you at the same time, a different aspect of the party. And so that corruption issue is angering people a lot. And so when you say, do people really want democracy, it's a very difficult thing to gauge. A lot of foreigners and business people who go to China say the Chinese aren't interested in democracy, they just want cash. And that's a real simplification mm-hmm. of the system. The Chinese want clear rules by which things can operate by. Mm-hmm. They want clarity and they want a fair shake. And if that to them means democracy, then that's very much that's democracy. Mm-hmm. And they want to be able to determine who determines their life. Mm-hmm. But to say, do they want to vote? No, in some cases they don't, because that's been so sullied by their constant propaganda streams against Western democracy. Mm. So it's a very complex picture.
So the party is, in a way, is in a race to buy people off, but it continues with these contradictions that at a certain point could lead to political protest of some sort, whether it's people being screwed because of what's happening to properties that they're part of, but more importantly on an issue like the environment, where this aggressive capitalism is not taking account or factoring in all the damage that's done to the environment. And in China, you really experience that,
yeah.
I guess.
I mean, the number of protests in China is growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. And the party's tactics for dealing with the protests are very relatively simple. They try to cut the head off and then buy off everybody else. And that's generally been relatively successful. And with the leadership, if the leadership has made connections with other protesters in other provinces, then they get into real trouble. They spend a lot of time in jail. Mm-hmm. Because that connection between groups is something that the party very much fears.
Mm-hmm. How you know, you here we have you here, somebody who arrives there as a student, you know, and you know they're having to deal with you, and you're having to sense how they're dealing with you, and so on. So I'm curious, as you watch these changes in China, it seems like there are pluses for the Chinese people's attitude toward the Americans generally, and their negatives. Talk a little about that. In other words, is there a core constituency in the middle class that really supports America, that really wants to see their children go to America to be educated, that would be very leery of any hostile encounter with the Americans? Or are they Chinese nationalists and loyal to their government on the other hand?
I mean, I think the average person's view of the United States and China is still relatively positive. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot less positive than it was in 1980 when I first went to China. Mm-hmm. And that's because of history. Mm-hmm. It's also because as we've gotten closer, we've gotten to know each other better. And mm-hmm. as you get to know someone better, you get to know all their mm-hmm. faults. Same with the two countries. Mm-hmm. The relationship, but America is definitely considered a wonderful place to educate one's children after grade school. Mm-hmm. And it's still a main destination for the Chinese elite to study. Mm-hmm. Hu Jintao's daughter, for example, studied in America. Jiang Zemin's son studied in America. So it's a great location. At the same time, there is a lot of anti-American propaganda in the Chinese media, and that's had a significant influence on Chinese. And at the same time, America's changed as well since 1980. So mm-hmm. the Chinese have changed as we've changed too.
What about the interdependency that we have a sense of here? You know, the extent to which China is acquiring and banking dollars, we're buying their products and creating these huge trade deficits. America, the U.S., from my perspective, seems to always think it can tell China what to do. What sort of a reaction is that getting, you know, in the country? Is China feeling its oats now and pushing back and willing to do that?
Yes. I mean, not in every case and every issue, but definitely. I mean, excuse me. But the relationship is obviously clear that they're inextricably interlinked. I mean, they have $800 billion some odd in U.S. Treasury bonds. We have a trade surplus with them of $200 billion mm-hmm. a year. You go to any Walmart. Of course, everything is made in China, and that relationship is only going to grow closer with time. It's quite clear. And the pressure that the U.S. administration exerts on China is sometimes enormous to do things that the Americans want them to do. But the Chinese, of course, don't want to be seen to be caving into American pressure, because that's politically untenable for them back in their own country. So, and you're going to see a lot more of that. I think the Chinese are becoming a lot more self-confident. And so there will be a lot more significant pushback as America pressures China in the future, especially with trade talks, et cetera, coming up, and the whole desire to have the Chinese revalue their currency.
As they're, you know, we're looking at a world where they're going to be the other power who potentially, you know, many years down the road could balance our power and check it. Given your studies and your lived-in experience there, and then you're working for the Washington Post there, what sort of a global power will China be, do you think?
I think that's a great question, Harry, and I think that's a big unknown. Currently, if they were suddenly tomorrow to turn into a global power, it would be a totally mercantile power that would have no human rights policy whatsoever, that would do business with anyone and everyone with a kind of cash on the table basis, and pursue aggressively their own interests without thinking of any broader issues of democracy or human rights whatsoever. So from Sudan to Zimbabwe to North Korea, they would be dealing like they're dealing now, but mm-hmm. at a higher level. And they would export their model, mm-hmm. Which is authoritarian governance and a freer market economy. And that model is actually of some significant attraction to states like Syria, for example, which has literally in the government's public statement saying that they like the Chinese model and they want to follow the Chinese model. So I think China has a significant thing to export to the rest of the world, which would be interested in adopting the Chinese model vis-a-vis a democratic model. So that's what I look at China right now. But the thing is that China is always changing. And this is a country that is now involved in a very serious search for meaning. Mm-hmm. What it means to be Chinese. What do we believe in? Now, most of the society is generally launched on this Deng Xiaoping journey to enrich themselves. But the Communist Party even recognizes that in China there's a moral vacuum. Public trust is at a real all-time low in that country. And the issue of public trust affects everything, not only their foreign policy, it also affects how business is done, it affects the crime rate, it affects the whole problem with Falun Gong and the growth of religious sects, etc. And society is now trying to deal with, what do we believe in? And I think as that debate happens in China, if it can happen organically, which is very difficult in an authoritarian system, but you could see the real possibility for change in China. It's going to be battled at every step by the Communist Party, which wants to control the debate. But the Communist Party recognizes it's a problem, so the Communist Party has begun to reintroduce Confucius back into society, which is ironic to say the least, considering in the 60s you could get thrown in the huskao for being a Confucian.
Yeah.
But that at least it illustrates the fact that the party recognizes that the society needs to believe in something. Now that Mao and Marx and all these other leftist shibboleths are gone, and that capitalism is really the system, the only system that they have to embrace, and they also understand that it's dangerous to totally go the other way and to embrace complete nationalism, because then you have the problem of the Nanjing demonstration against the blacks in 1988.
Or against the Japanese.
Exactly. Yeah. The first 2 days it's against the Japanese, the first 2 days against the blacks, on the next day it becomes against the regime. And that is something that you can't control. That nationalist passion that anti-black passion, whatever passion, once it's turned against the party state, it becomes very difficult to control.
In an earlier period when we were trying to deal with the Soviet Union and its emergence as a great power, there was a big debate about, well, how do you shape their future? And that question really applies to what impact can we have on China in the process that you just described? Because clearly, if we do too much, there will be an opposite reaction to what we're proposing. But you must have a sense of the subtle ways in which America can help lead China to its global role.
Well, my sense, for a long time, U.S.-China foreign policy has been run by a group of very educated, effectively mandarins, if you will, people who understand China and think they know best what's best for U.S.-China relations. And so often our relations with China are couched in terms of, well, China has to be treated as a special case because it's a special case, because the Chinese have issues of face, the Chinese are more prickly, the Chinese don't like to be criticized, these type of issues, and that we can only achieve things in China much more slowly than we can achieve with other countries. I think China really needs to first be treated like a normal country, because the more you treat China like a normal country, the less it will demand special treatment, which is a prerequisite for any normal relations between states. I think that would be a basis to try to move from, because it's, for too long it's been a special relationship, and I think that's not a productive thing, because it gives the Chinese leadership the sense that they can get away with things that they really shouldn't be allowed to get away with.
Do you think the environment will be a thing that we might walk into the future together, that we can point things out to them that they're very much behind on? Yeah.
Yes, but I also think, like, for example, human rights issues or civil rights issues or poverty issues, the thing that the United States can do best in terms of having that type of relationship with China is clean up its own house and improve its own situation. So as we improve our environment, then China will come along to improve its environment. Of course, there's also the trade possibilities of clean technology. That's a huge area of growth. But as America cleans up its environment, as America improves its civil rights, that becomes much more of a powerful beacon to China than us yammering at the Chinese and telling them what they should do. I think leading by example is much more important than leading by vitriol.
One final question, a brief answer. Students watching this program, they want to study China, they want to report on China, they want to do something with it. How do you advise them to prepare for that future of theirs?
Well, go there. Mm-hmm. I think go there. Obviously, Beijing is fun. There's lots of foreign students there. Shanghai is great, too. But I would go into the interior, as long as they don't speak a dialect that's too unintelligible, and spend time there. Spend a lot of time traveling. Travel by yourself. That's amazing. I once traveled by myself for 30 days and didn't speak any English at all. Mm. It's a great experience. It really is a great experience, and it's an amazing country. It's not as beautiful as it used to be, but there's still some wonderful places there.
John, on that note, thank you. I want to thank you very much for
thank
coming
you.
Back.
Thanks
I want to
having.
Show our audience your book again and recommend it very highly. Chinese Lessons gives a real sense of the granularity of China and how it's changing to inform a kind of the bigger picture. Thank you very much, and thank you again. And
thanks,
thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.